Russia says it's launched a criminal case after American social media networks, Facebook and Instagram, allow calls for violence against the Russian soldiers in Ukraine. Iran reiterates its position on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, with Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian saying that war is not a solution to the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. And Iran says it reserves the right to respond to Israel's criminal acts after the regime's latest terrorist attack left two Iranian advisory forces dead in Syria. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Russia's military offensive in Ukraine is now in its 17th day as Russian forces bear down on the capital, Kiev, while the city of Lutsk, close to the Polish border, is targeted for a first time. Russian forces have repositioned and regrouped just northwest of Kiev. Airfields in the western cities of Lutsk and Ivano-Frankivsk have also come under attack. In east-central Ukraine, Russian strikes have hit Dnipro for a first time, killing one person. Ukraine has accused Russian forces of hitting a psychiatric hospital near the eastern Ukrainian town of Izyum. Russia's defense ministry says it will open humanitarian corridors from Kiev, Sumy, Kharkiv, Mariupol, and Chernihiv. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated in recent days through humanitarian corridors. The UN Human Rights Office says nearly 600 civilians, including 41 children, have so far been killed in Ukraine. Online video sharing platform YouTube says it is blocking access globally to media funded by the Russian government. The American platform says the decision is in line with its policy of barring content which denies, minimizes, or trivializes violent events. Earlier this month, YouTube also blocked leading Russian channels RT and Sputnik across Europe amid Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Meanwhile, American company Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, says it is allowing posts which call for violence against Russian forces. In response, Moscow says it is restricting access to Instagram and has launched criminal proceedings against its parent company. The UN has also warned the anti-Moscow move could spark hate speech against Russians. The UN Security Council today was a scene of fierce dispute over alleged biolabs in Ukraine. Russia insists the U.S. has financed a biological weapons research program in the country, while Washington has held its ground in denying the accusation. Now, Russia's U.N. envoy told the meeting that Ukrainian government has allowed its own people to be used as guinea pigs for a biological weapons research. Vasily Nebenzia said the labs have studied how to spread viruses using birds and bats, citing as evidence growing number of disease outbreaks which have been reported in Ukraine in recent years. Russian envoy warned the European countries of the danger posed by Ukraine's research into biological weapons, but the U.S. envoy Linda Thomas-Greenfield rejected Russia's allegation of U.S. biological activity, claiming that biological laboratories in Ukraine have nothing to do with chemical arms. She said such accusations are a sign that Moscow itself is planning to use chemical or biological weapons in Ukraine. UN disarmament chief told the meeting the organization is not aware of any biological weapons program in Ukraine. The government in Kiev has denied any such program on Ukrainian soil. Joining us now for an extended conversation on what's going on in Ukraine is Joe Lombardo, United National Anti-War Coalition, joining us from New York, and Mr. Jim Kavanaugh, founder of the polemicist.net, also joining us from New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with Mr. Joe Lombardo. Good to have you on, Joe. Your thoughts about day 17, where we stand with respect to this Ukraine-Russia conflict?
Well, of course, it's very unfortunate that there is such a conflict. However, I think it was clear that it could only go in the way it has. The United States has continually moved closer and closer to the Russian border and was going to allow Ukraine as part of NATO, was for that, which could put missiles 4 minutes from Moscow, and that was a red line that Russia could not live with. Additionally, in the Ukraine government and in the Ukraine military, there are very right-wing forces such as the Azov Battalion, which are neo-Nazis, which carry swastikas as flags, who are in favor of destroying Russia and all Russians. So they could not allow that to happen. And in a very cautious way, they've entered Ukraine. They have not done it the way the United States did it, for instance, in Iraq with shock and awe, where they massively bombed the cities, or in Vietnam, where they carpet bombed Hanoi. They did it in a very, very cautious way, and they came in by land, giving people plenty of time to leave, opening up humanitarian corridors. And I think that's the situation that we see today. However, Russian forces are making very steady progress towards the goal of securing Donbas and trying to rid their neighboring country of fascist elements.
Thank you, Joe. And Jim, I'd like to welcome you to the program, Mr. Jim Kavanaugh, also joining us from New York. Now, Jim, you watch CNN, you watch Fox for about 15, 20 minutes, and you walk away with this idea that Vladimir Putin and the Russians, malevolent, brutal, violent, evil. Is it a fair assessment in your point of view, yes or no, and why or why not?
Well, look, American academics and politicians and foreign policy experts for decades have said that NATO expansion in Eastern Europe is a red line for Russia. It's going to provoke them. The present head of the CIA said, William Burns, if we go into in Ukraine, it's going to provoke them. You can find any number. John Mersheimer just said what the United States is doing is leading Ukraine down a primrose path that's going to end up wrecking the country. Because even if, I don't forget exactly who said it, but even if Mahatma Gandhi was the leader of Russia, he couldn't accept the United States bringing Ukraine into NATO and bringing NATO into Ukraine. So this is something that was predicted and predictable, and Ukraine has become, unfortunately, a pawn in the game of Western American imperialism, really. And since 2014, when a democratically elected government certified in an election that the NATO and European observers said was really good and really democratic, was overthrown, the vanguard of that coup was right-wing fascists. And since then, they've joined with the United States in an offensive against Russia. So this was predicted to happen. And the Russians, for 15 years, Vladimir Putin said, we've got to stop with this NATO expansion. And for 8 years, he's tried to get some kind of settlement in Ukraine. And it was never going to happen. So he decided the only way to do it was this way. It's unfortunate. But we're now on a path where we're in a very dangerous path, because the Russians cannot afford to lose this, and they will not back off.
And Joe, I'd like to get your take on how much power someone like a Zuckerberg has in a conflict like this, when he gets to snuff out voices that are pro-Russian, and basically people are saying death to Putin and death to Russian forces. They have a platform on Facebook. They have a platform on its sister Instagram. But yet, if you're pro-Palestinian, if you're against the war in Yemen, you get snuffed out. You get basically shut down. How does that equate when there's a certain belief in the U.S. that you have a freedom to assemble, a freedom to speak, a freedom of speech and assembly, and not only that, to express whatever your opinion may be?
Well, I think freedom of press and freedom of assembly and freedom to speak has been under attack for a long time in the United States. You could look at the case of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. They want to put him in jail for 175 years for telling the truth. Nobody can say that he didn't tell the truth. He just told of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. We in the political movement here know for a long time our right to demonstrate has been under attack. We used to be able to demonstrate in the streets as we wanted to. Now they define what they call free speech zones, usually miles away from the target that we want to demonstrate, and say you can demonstrate there and try to isolate us in those ways. But the coming into being of these social media, which are privately owned, these have become platforms for freedom of speech, but they're privately owned, and these people can simply decide who can speak and who cannot speak. And there's no recourse. If it was a government, if you wanted to have a demonstration in the street and they tried to restrict you, you can go to the local government or the state government or whoever, and you can protest or you can vote against them. But you can't do that when free speech is controlled by these platforms and they're privately controlled. Like everything else in the society in the United States, from the military to the prisons, now we see freedom of speech as being privately controlled. And this goes against everything that they've been trying to say in reverse about Russia, when they start saying that it's okay to talk about violence against Russians and violence against Russia, because we know what that means in this country. When they started talking anti-China in this country, Chinese people were attacked in the streets and they were beaten up. We see it with blacks and other minorities in this country. So this is a very, very dangerous precedent. All people of goodwill and conscience in the United States are opposed to it.
And Jim, you want to weigh in on that? The ramifications of social media, once again, getting to control or manipulate at least the narrative.
Yeah, well, this is a war. The narrative war is an important war. And unfortunately, Russia doesn't know how to play it very well. But, you know, this has been going on for years now, the attempt to limit what's being said on social media platforms and to limit the freedom of speech on the internet. And people have been sucked into this, you know, because it was Alex Jones or Donald Trump and it was a mistake. You know, they're out to constrain the limits of speech as much as possible, to narrow the Overton window and to go after anybody who's against the establishment. So this has been going on for years and this is the culmination of it. We're now in really a situation of essentially wartime censorship. And I'll just say this about these are private companies, but really they are controlled by the government. These are government officials and Atlantic Council people who send letters and who threaten them to take people off the internet. And in doing so, they're actually, you know, going against the laws about they're not supposed to be curating. If they're curating, if they're editing their platforms, they no longer have immunity for what's said. But they're not supposed to be doing that. To get that immunity, they're supposed to have an open platform. And it's the government who's pushing them not to do that. And also, it's just crazy because, you know, if I post a picture of the Azov battalion in their Nazi regalia that comes from the Ukrainian Defense Ministry website on Facebook, they'll take it down. But now the Azov battalion can post what they want, and they can post things saying kill Russians. So the Nazis can post what they want, but we can't show that they're Nazi. We can't show them on it. It's the most bizarre thing in the world.
All right, thank you, gentlemen, both of you. It's always a pleasure to check in with you both. Joe Lombardo and Jim Kavanaugh, both joining us out of New York, and that's it for this extended conversation on the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister reiterates that the Islamic Republic's stance regarding the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and that is ending the conflict through political resolution. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the war is not a solution in Ukraine, just as in Yemen, Afghanistan, or anywhere else. He made the remarks in a phone conversation with his Polish counterpart, Zbigniew Rau. The Iranian top diplomat also thanked the Polish government for its assistance to refugees in the Ukrainian conflict, especially Iranians. Amir Abdullahian said that Iran is prepared to send humanitarian aid to refugees in Poland. The Polish diplomat welcomed the offer, calling on the international community to send more humanitarian aid to his country, or pardon, to Ukraine and its neighboring countries. Iran says that it reserves the right to respond to Israeli terrorist attack, which killed two military advisors in Syria. The Iranian mission to the United Nations says attack was highly provocative and aimed at increasing tensions. In a letter to the Security Council, mission seriously warned Israel against taking further adventuristic and malevolent measures. Mission also described the attack as a criminal act, which violates international law and the United Nations Charter. It called on the international community to firmly condemn such actions and hold Israel accountable. On March 7th, the regime launched airstrikes at a site near the Syrian capital, Damascus. They killed two members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps who were in Syria on an advisory role. Yemeni armed forces say that they've carried out a large-scale drone operation targeting Saudi Arabia's oil facilities.
Has carried out a wide military operation, the first Black Sea operation, using 9 drones. The targeting of the Aramco refinery in the Saudi enemy's capital Riyadh using Samad 3 drones, the targeting of Aramco facilities in Jizan and Abha and other sensitive locations using 6 Samad 1 drones.
Army spokesman said the operation was a response to Riyadh's fuel embargo on Yemen. Sari said his country is ready to carry out more operations in retaliation for Saudi Arabia's aggression and blockade. Saudi state news agency has cited a government official confirming that a refinery in Riyadh was attacked Thursday. The news agency, however, said the attack caused a small fire which was contained and the refinery's operations and supplies were not affected. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed Israel's so-called citizenship law, which bars Palestinian residents from living with their spouses from Gaza or the occupied West Bank. Hamas spokesman Jihad Taha said the legislation reveals the true face of the occupying regime, which is after separating Palestinian families. Taha said the move aims at clearing Palestinian lands, especially Al-Quds, from their original residents. He noted Hamas strongly rejects what he called this racist law. Spokesman added it is in violation of international norms, including the 1948 Global Declaration of Human Rights. And condemnations continue to pour in over the recent visit of the Israeli president to Turkey. The International Union for Muslim Scholars says hosting Isaac Herzog runs counter to the Turkish nation's Islamic and human obligations in the face of Israeli crimes against Palestinians. The Qatari-based Islamic institution said Herzog's trip was aimed at undermining Palestinians' battle against occupation. It branded the move as in line with attempts to condone normalization of ties with Israel. Earlier, Palestinian resistance groups said hosting the Israeli leader amounts to a betrayal of Palestinians. People in Turkey also denounced Herzog's visit. The Israeli president met Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Wednesday, shortly after landing in Ankara for a one-day visit. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
New research has shown that governments and individuals making small changes can have a huge impact in reducing carbon emissions. We are prepared for you an article written by Matthew Taylor. The piece is titled Study Finds Six Key Lifestyle Changes Can Help Avert the Climate Crisis. According to new research from three leading institutions, people in well-off countries can help avert climate breakdown by making six relatively straightforward lifestyle changes. The new study found that sticking to six specific commitments, from flying no more than once every 3 years to only buying three new items of clothing a year, could rein in the runaway consumption that is partially driving the climate crisis. The new research, carried out by academics at Leeds University in England and analysed by experts at the global engineering firm Arup and the C40 group of world cities, found that making the six commitments could account for a quarter of the emissions reductions required to keep the global heating down to just 1.5 degrees Celsius. The new study was published on Monday alongside the launch of a new climate movement to persuade and support relatively well-off people to make the jump and sign up to the six pledges. Tom Bailey, co-founder of the campaign, said, "This ends once and for all the debate about whether citizens can have a role in protecting our Earth. We don't have time to wait for one group to act. We need all action from all actors now." Recently, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, issued its bleakest warning yet, saying the climate crisis was accelerating rapidly, with only a narrow chance left to avoid its worst ravages. Tom Bailey, co-founder of the campaign, said, "As the world reaches the edge of ecological collapse, it needed a workable alternative to this universal consumer society in the next decade." Tom Bailey added, "The research is clear that governments and the private sector have the largest role to play, but it is also equally clear from our analysis that individuals and communities can also make a huge difference." The Jump campaign asks people to sign up to take the following six shifts for 1, 3, or 6 months. 1. Eat a largely plant-based diet with healthy portions and no waste. 2. Buy no more than 3 new items of clothing per year. 3. Keep electrical products for at least 7 years. 4. Take no more than 1 short-haul flight every 3 years, and 1 long-haul flight every 8 years. 5. Get rid of personal motor vehicles if you can, and if not, keep hold of your existing vehicle for longer. And 6. Make at least 1 life shift to nudge the system, like moving to a green energy, insulating your home, or changing pension supplier. The campaign was officially kicked off on Saturday, 5th of February, and Tom Bailey said there was already a growing movement emerging in response to the evidence, with jump groups up and running around the country. Tom Bailey added, "This is not just new information or a normal behaviour change campaign, but a fun movement that is working to go way beyond the usual greeny suspects." He added, "A movement that is able to engage all types of people, engaging and being led by communities of colour and economically excluded." Tom Bailey said there has been a widespread belief in climate circles in recent years that individual action was relatively ineffective, and the only option was to get out on the streets and demand system change from governments and corporations, adding, Obviously, this is still hugely important, but what this new research shows is that there is a role for a new joyful climate movement which can help lead the way to less stuff and more joy. Some of the shifts the campaign calls for are at least partially dependent on systemic change. The prohibitive cost of train fares might leave individuals with little choice but to use short-haul flights for essential journeys. Public transport may be expensive or non-existent in areas of the country, leaving people with no choice but to use their car. Tom Bailey was the lead author of Labour's plan to decarbonise the UK's energy sector at the last election. He has worked in the green energy sector in the United Kingdom, US and China for the past 15 years and said individual actions could have a cascade effect, leading to community-level action and ultimately contributing to systemic change. He said although not everyone would be able to commit to all the pledges, just making a start could have a big impact. He added, "This isn't going back to the Stone Age, it's just finding a balance. Less consuming in relatively rich Western countries can mean more creativity, comedy, connection. Live for joy, not for stuff." The research is based on a study by academics at Leeds University in England, ARUP, and the C40 group of leading cities, which assesses the impact of consumption by people in the world's leading cities. Analysis of the data has found that 6 steps set out above could cut global carbon emissions by between 25% and 27%. Ben Smith, Director of Climate Change at ARUP, who led the analysis, said that as scientific evidence mounts, it was clear that all sections of society had to act. Ben Smith said, "Our research shows that all of us, from politicians, city and business leaders to individual citizens, have important roles to play, and it is clear there's lots that we can do as individuals, and that this is one of the easiest and quickest places to start."
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen, from every single corner of the world, wherever you are, welcome to your program. This is Arab English Radio. You're hearing me from Back to Reality. I am your humble host, Asma, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Brother Hassanain and Brother Sayyid Jaffa.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Very pleased to meet you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for being here. So, as the ritual of this program, at the very beginning, we ask about the academical background of your study. So, shall you please tell us a little bit about your study?
Yeah, sure. I'm Hassanain and I'm from India. I'm an Islamic seminary student and studying in here in Qom.
So, wish you all the best. And you, brother? You.
My name is Sayyid Jaffer. I'm from America. And I, myself, am also a seminary student studying here in Qom.
So, wish you luck. Thank you for being here. Just to start today's discussion, I would put it this way. As human beings, we are brought into this world in order to be tested. True. Every day of our life is a single challenge between good and bad.
Yeah.
Between the evil and the good. So the question is, how could we, as human beings who have emotions and who have to think, how could we just pick sides and figure out which is right and which is wrong. That is the everlasting fight between halal and batil. How could we distinguish the two of them?
In order to distinguish the right and wrong path, like there are certain parameters, if you see that a certain thing comes under that parameter, you can that will be easier for you to identify whether it's right or wrong. Suppose, for example, someone asked me a question, like in today's world, like there are so many scholars and, you know, scholars are of different mindsets, different ideologies. Like me, being a Shia, being a Muslim, which scholar should I follow?
Exactly. That's
so, like, the different ideologies, right? Like, and different ideologies, like, you know, it's like completely different. Like, someone is saying something and the other one's like completely opposite to that. So, a common man, like, you know, he's trying to learn Islam and he doesn't know much about Islam. So, what's his job to do now? So, you know, the simple rule is just when you listen to any scholar, if you think that you're getting closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and you're getting closer to Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, you get to know that he's the right one. Like that scholar, specific scholar is the right one.
So the ideal is putting God's satisfaction in front of us.
Ahsantum, yeah, that's the idea. That should be our standard. Like if you're getting closer to Allah and Ahlul Bayt, you're going in the right path. Yeah. And vice versa. If you think you're getting away from him, just get away from that scholar too.
That's what. So, Brother Jaffa, what's your idea?
Well, I just want to piggyback off of Brother Hussein on what he said. It's the scholars that you're around, say the books that were left behind by them, the teachings of the prophets, the imams, what they practically based, say, haq and truthfulness off of, you want to go based on that. And anything that would lead you away from what they've said would be considered going towards evil.
Just imagine there's no scholar that we follow. We have to go it by ourselves. Shall we trust our instincts?
In a sense, if there is no scholar, I think you have to go based off of your instincts. But just by trying to listen to other scholars and see other people's viewpoints, you get an idea of what is.
So we must ask and search.
Exactly. It's not just our instincts, but more of us trying to search to see what is true and what is false.
Exactly. That's a very difficult situation. You know, as human beings, it has been always like this. We live for, I don't know how many time we have as our lifetime, but it's going to be very difficult to pick between the right and the wrong.
Yeah, as Brother Jaffa said, you know, we have the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and a hadith and all. So we need to follow that, like in the way Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam has already said, where there's Ali, there's Haq.
Yes.
So Ali ma'al Haq wal Haq ma'al Ali. So where there's Ali, there's Haq. So you need to walk in the path of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
You need to
be on the path of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. That's Sirat al-Mustaqim. Sirat al-Mustaqim, as per Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salam, is Amir al-Mu'mineen. So you need to follow Imam Ali and his teachings. So to be on the right path, you follow the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
So we must follow Ahl al-Bayt, and also we must just focus on the fact that where stands the satisfaction of Allah.
Yeah.
That is the point. So right now, let's go for a little break and we'll be back after just a short interval. Thank you for listening, guys.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Now, since we're living in a world which has been devastated by many wars, what about wars? How shall we distinguish which side is the right and which side is the wrong? That's very difficult to pick.
I would say the same thing. Even for war, you would want to look at both sides, right? You don't want to be biased towards one side or the other. You want to look at both sides and see what their objectives, what their goals are. What the main purpose of, say, this war is. And
you know,
again,
but
you
there's
would go,
always propaganda that would tell you which one is right.
That's true. But then at the end of the day, you want to go back to and see the teachings of the imams and see which one is closer to that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, as you said, propaganda is there to sway the people who are in the middle, who don't know which side to pick, to get more people on their own side.
Yes.
Are you talking about the historical wars that used to happen before in the time of your early Islam or the happening wars? If you're talking about the old wars, then again, that's the standard. Where you see Imam Ali, that's the right side.
Exactly.
Because that is the idol of haq and truth.
As Brother Jafar said, the objectives of the two sides are very important. Which one is doing what based on what goal? So that is the important thing. Also, these wars happen inside of us every single day. And as I told you, it's very hard and very difficult to distinguish between haq and batil. Because if it was so easy, then there wouldn't have been all these learnings, all these studies, all these books. And still, human beings are not could have been not lost in today's life. But let's just talk more about the internal war that might happen according to haq and batil.
As Brother Jafar said, like objectives.
Mm-hmm.
Objectives. If you talk about the wars that are happening now, so first we need to look into the situation. Like, why is the war happening? And like, who are the oppressors and who are the oppressed? And what basis this war's going to take place? Like, if we do the study, then we get to know that who are on haq and who are on batil. Like,
yes,
this war shouldn't
true.
Be just, you know, for worldly pleasures, just to expand your boundaries.
Exactly.
If you're fighting for your right, then that might be called, you know, a proper war. But if you're just fighting to expand your territories and expand your power, like, this is not a right war.
But the army of Batil are usually so powerful, and they have all these facilities to make Haq look like Batil. You know what I mean?
That's the card that the enemy plays.
Exactly. That's how they make Haq looks like. You know, I mean, we are right. I mean, I'm just giving an example. We're right in a specific situation. But then the other side tries to use all the power and all the facilities they have in their hand to show as it's not true. The other side is not true, and it's just being playing the role of batil, though it's right and haq.
If you look into the history, if you study about Jang of Siffin, the Battle of Siffin, where Hazrat Ammar Yasir, the Sahabi, the companion of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was martyred in Jang of Siffin. When he got martyred, the narrative, the hadith from Prophet, it spread among the people that Prophet said that Hazrat Ammar Yasir, whoever kills him will be taghut, will be on batil, will be, you know, the bad side or the false.
The devil.
Yeah, it will be the devil. So when people got to know that this hadith, Ammar Yasir will be killed by the devils. So they're thinking then, you know, Muawiyah and Amr ibn As, they got into, you know, like they were thinking, what can we do now? Like, according to the hadith of Rasulullah, now we are, you know, supposed to be on the devil side.
Exactly.
So, you know, you look, you know, Amr ibn As was a crony friend of Muawiyah. Like, he was really vice. What he advised was, you know, he completely changed the scenario. He completely, you know, he turned the story upside down. He said, okay, Ammar Yasir got martyred in the war of Siffin. It's right that our soldiers, like from our battlefield, our soldiers killed him. But who got him into the battlefield?
Yes.
So that's how enemies, they turn the story upside down.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
So, welcome. welcome back to your program. We were talking about haq and batil, which is the wrong and the right and the truth. The important thing is that there is a thread, a very delicate thread between haq and batil, and distinguishing this is a very difficult and challenging story. So, Brother Jafar, do you want to add anything?
Well, going back to the war that Brother Hussain brought up, even in that war, the main group of people were still confused because they didn't know if they were going to be with Imam Ali or with Muawiyah, who brought in the Quran saying that we are the people with the Quran, don't go against us. Just like these tactics themselves confused the middle group, right? That those are the real people that you want to sway either towards haq or batil, right? There's a small group that they believe, they know, and they believe that they're on the side of haq. And there's the other side that they know they're on the side of batil, but they want to confuse the main public to an extent.
To perplex the situation.
Exactly. To make it seem like, no, we're the good guys and the people that you think are good, they aren't good.
Yes, just as I told you. And we see it right now in modern days. All the revolutions that oppressed people do, the propagandas try to show them as the batil. Though they are being oppressed and they are tolerating so much of a difficult situation. So we're going to wrap it up. If the guests have anything to add, I will be very pleased.
Sister, I would just like to add on the last point. Since we're talking about haq and batil in terms of war, so I would like to say the main standard, we have spoken about different objectives, to identify the good side and the bad side.
Yes.
But the main standard, if someone himself is participating in a war, is he should check whether his war is for Lillah, is it for Allah
that
or not.
That is very important.
There's a main point, there's a main standard, to identify anything, to check whether it's the right way or the wrong way.
Exactly.
If you're battling with someone, just check, is it for Allah or not? Is it for the satisfaction of Allah?
That is very true. Brother Jafar, do you have anything to add?
Nothing really. Brother Hussain really said it all right there. That at the end of the day, the goal for these wars is, look, are you doing this for the satisfaction of God or are you doing it for yourself? Because at the end of the day, if you end up doing it for yourself or for some personal gain, you're in the wrong.
That makes it clear that you're in the wrong side of the story. So thank you very much for listening to us. This is all the time we have. We talked about haq and batil, and we understood that there are some borderlines that shows us the truth and makes it clear which side is the right. So thank you for listening.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again. Once again.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
One year after a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol, Republicans and Democrats are deeply divided over what happened on that day and the degree to which former President Donald Trump bears responsibility for the assault, amid more universal signs of flagging pride in the workings of democracy at home, according to a Washington Post University of Maryland poll. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalist Dan Bowles, Scott Clement, and Emily Guskin. The piece is titled Republicans and Democrats Divided Over 6th of January Insurrection and Trump's Culpability. Post-UMD Poll Finds. Stay with us for more. One year after a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol, Republicans and Democrats are deeply divided over what happened on that day and the degree to which former President Donald Trump bears responsibility for the assault, amid more universal signs of flagging pride in the workings of democracy at home, according to a new Washington Post, University of Maryland opinion poll. Partisan divisions related both to the 6th of January assault and the 2020 presidential election color nearly every issue raised in the survey, from how much violence occurred at the Capitol that day to the severity of the sentences handed down to convicted protesters, to whether President Biden was legitimately elected. Only on a question about injured law enforcement officers is there broad bipartisan agreement. The percentage of Americans who say violent action against the government is justified at times stands at 34%, which is considerably higher than in past opinion polls by the Washington Post or other major news organizations dating back more than two decades. Again, the view is partisan. The new opinion survey finds 40% of Republicans, 41% of independents, and 23% of Democrats saying violence is sometimes justified. On 6th of January, the day Congress was to ratify the 2020 Electoral College vote, Donald Trump claimed at a rally near the White House that the election had been rigged and urged his followers to fight like hell to stop what he said was a stolen outcome. Many of his supporters walked to the Capitol from the rally and took part in the violence. Overall, 60% of the American people say Donald Trump bears either a great deal or a good amount of responsibility for the insurrection on 6th of January. But 72% of Republicans and 83% of Trump voters say he bears just some responsibility or no responsibility at all. Trump's attacks on the legitimacy of the election have spawned ongoing efforts in some states to revisit the results. No such inquiry has turned up anything to suggest that the certified results were inaccurate. That has not blunted a persistent belief by most of his supporters that the election was somehow rigged. Overall, the Washington Post University of Maryland survey finds that 68% of the American people say there is no solid evidence of widespread fraud, but 30% of the American people say there is. Big majorities of Democrats, 88%, and independents, 74%, say there is no evidence of such irregularities. But 62% of Republicans say there is such evidence of voting irregularities. That is almost identical to the percentage of Republicans who agreed with Donald Trump's claims of voter fraud a week after that Capitol attack, based on a Washington Post ABC News opinion poll at the time. About 7 in 10 Americans say Joe Biden's election as president was legitimate, but that leaves almost 3 in 10 who say it was not, including 58% of Republicans and 27% of independents. The 58% of Republicans who say Joe Biden was not legitimately elected as president is down somewhat from 70% in the Washington Post ABC News opinion poll conducted in January, shortly after a Capitol attack. Among those who say they voted for Donald Trump in 2020, 69% now say Joe Biden was not legitimately elected, while 97% of Biden voters say the current president was legitimately elected. Republicans' rejection of Biden's victory is not novel. In a fall 2017 Washington Post University of Maryland opinion poll, 67% of Democrats and 69% of Hillary Clinton voters said Donald Trump was not legitimately elected president. The current opinion poll was conducted between 17 and 19th of December by the Washington Post and the University of Maryland Center for Democracy and Civic Engagement. Overall, the new survey reflects how much the partisan wars continue to rage across the country, a full year after the 6th of January riot. Donald Trump has fueled the discord with falsehoods about election irregularities, and most Republican elected officials have turned their backs on any serious investigation of the roots of the attack and exactly what transpired on that day. Hopes for unity have largely faded, as doubts about democracy have grown. The 6th of January attack left one police officer and four others dead, and scores injured, particularly those in law enforcement who were overwhelmed for a time as the mob of Donald Trump's supporters broke into the Capitol. Since then, some Republicans have sought to play down the violence, with one member of Congress even saying the mob resembled ordinary tourists rather than attackers. Trump also has sought to minimize the violence of the day, contending falsely in December that, remember, the insurrection took place on 3rd of November. It was the completely unarmed protest of the rigged election that took place on 6th of January. Today, 54% of Americans characterized the protesters who entered the Capitol as mostly violent, while 19% call them mostly peaceful, and another 27% say they were equally peaceful and violent. Broken down by party, 78% of Democrats described the protesters as mostly violent, compared with 26% of Republicans. 36% of Republicans say the protesters were mostly peaceful, compared to just 5% of Democrats. A bare majority overall, 51%, say the legal punishments for those who broke the law on that day are not harsh enough, with 19% saying they are too harsh and 28% saying overall they have been fair. The partisan differences are virtually identical to perceptions about how violent the protests were, with 77% of Democrats calling the penalties not harsh enough, compared with 26% of the Republicans. 7 in 10 Republicans say the penalties have been either fair, 38%, or too harsh, 32%. An estimated 140 law enforcement personnel were injured during the attack on 6th of January, a fact that overwhelming majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents agree happened. The survey finds that 96% of Democrats and 81% of Republicans and 84% of Independents say that protesters injured police officers during the attack on the Capitol. Partisan divisions also largely disappear on a question about pride in democracy itself, with 54% saying they're either very or somewhat proud of the way democracy is working in the United States. That includes 60% of Democrats, 58% of Republicans, and 51% of independents. But that finding, while narrowly in positive territory, highlights what has been a dramatic and steady two-decade decline in how the American people feel about their democracy. In the fall of 2002, a year after the attacks of 11th of September 2001, 90% of adults expressed pride in the workings of American democracy. Just 12 years later, it had fallen to 74%. And in the fall of 2017, it had dropped again to just 63%. Notably, in 2002, 49% of American adults say they were very proud of the way democracy was working in this country. In the survey, that number had plunged to just 11%, as both sides found reasons for dismay. Two decades ago, Republicans and Democrats were uniform in their pride in democracy, with more than 9 in 10 in each party expressing positive views. That trend continued throughout the following decade or more, though overall pride in democracy was sliding down among both groups and independents. In 2017, a partisan division opened up, with Republicans more positive than Democrats in the wake of Donald Trump's election. Today, as the percentage who express pride has fallen even further, Republicans and Democrats are closer together in their views. About 4 in 10 of each say they are not proud of American democracy. A majority of most demographic groups in the survey express pride in democracy, but two somewhat overlapping groups stand out for their pessimism. Among independents who say they do not lean to either party, 58% say they are not proud of the current workings of US democracy. While among those aged 18 to 29, 54% have a negative perception of democracy as it exists in the United States today. There is little difference in perceptions depending on which cable news sources they watch. Those who watch Fox News and those who watch CNN have almost identical views about how they feel about democracy today. In both cases, nearly 6 in 10 say they have some pride about democracy's workings, while among those who watch MSNBC, just over 6 in 10 are positive. The past year has seen an intense debate over the rules and regulations governing elections. In some Republican-controlled states, new laws have been passed that would restrict voting, with some provisions seen as falling hardest on African Americans, Hispanics, and the elderly. Democrats nationally have championed federal legislation designed to expand voting rights, but have not been able to get their bills through the Senate. Looking ahead, more than 1 in 3 Americans say they are not confident that their votes will be counted in the 2022 midterm elections.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.